So we return to our chapter, The Ascent of the Sacrifice, The Works of Knowledge, The Psychic Beam, Chapter 5 in the Yoga of Divine Works. We begin from the position that Sri Aurobindo has insisted that all must be integrated based on a realization of the higher divine consciousness and reaching back to claim all of life's properties and activities into that. But first, there has to be that essential realization, paravidya, claiming the field of aparavidya, is secondary. First, one must realize. Then one can collect, aggrandize, transform. Pardon me. So, this then is the true relation between divine and human knowledge. It is not a separation into disparate fields, sacred and profane. That is the heart of the difference. But the character of the consciousness behind the working. All is human knowledge that proceeds from the ordinary mental consciousness interested in the outside or upper layers of things, in process, in phenomena, for their own sake, or for the sake of some surface utility or mental or vital satisfaction of desire or of the intelligence. But the same activity of knowledge can become part of the yoga if it proceeds from the spiritual or spiritualizing consciousness, which seeks and finds in all that it surveys or penetrates the presence of the timeless eternal and the ways of manifestation of the eternal in time. So this posits the essential realization and then the ways, the methods, the modes of articulation that that supreme conscious power possesses. So not simply the essence, but the tattvas that proceed from that, part of the field of the higher knowledge as it extends down. So he's describing here the inner pitch of the ascent of consciousness and the governance of life from that supreme poise where we are released from egoity and from containment in the field of manifestation, in the field of the senses, in the field of thoughts, in the field of sensations. We are back to that original point of conscious expression from true being when we are in that realization. It is evident, he writes, that the need of a concentration indispensable for the transition out of the ignorance may make it necessary for the seeker to gather his energies and focus them only on that which will help the transition, and to leave aside or subordinate for the time all that is not directly turned towards the one object. Well, this we do when we simply sit for meditation. Yes, that is what dharana is. We sit, and all the strands of our being that are normally dispersed out, we bring them back, all the thoughts, all the feelings, all the physical sensations into one compass, and we brood upon them. That is tapas. We build heat. That is concentration. The practice of it is tapasya. The reality of it is the heat, but it is all part of the field of dharana. This is, as he says in other places in the synthesis of yoga and in his correspondence, the means by which we attain victory in yoga. To apply the will, to apply concentration, is what liberates, because you build strength where it was weakness. You build consciousness where it was ignorance. He continues, he may find that this or that pursuit of human knowledge with which he was accustomed to deal by the surface power of the mind still brings him, by reason of this tendency or habit, out of the depths to the surface, or down from the heights which he has climbed or is nearing to lower levels. So, if you can climb into the interior depths and move into the gulfs of the soul consciousness, or climb into the dimensions of the spiritual consciousness above the human mind, if you are not fully seated, if you don't find that your water level has become the same as that, then you may drift back down. Gravity may pull you back to the old condition, and you begin to lose the consciousness that you gained. This is what he means here. These activities then may have to be intermitted or put aside until, secure in a higher consciousness, he is able to turn its powers on all the mental fields. Then, subjected to that light or taken up into it, they are turned, by the transformation of his consciousness, into a province of the spiritual and divine. So, whatever period of time is necessary to make secure the inner gain, it might be incumbent upon the aspirant to stand apart from the ordinary, the customary routine, until the victory is assured. Rushing too quickly back into the old familiar formulas may pull you away from what you thought you had grasped. We can't afford to lose it. These experiences, when they come, have to be captured and assimilated and made solid and concrete. Then we slowly come back and assume the old rounds of life and see what is adaptable to the spirit's intent and what isn't. So first, get that consciousness, and then subject all to the light of that consciousness, and then transform that consciousness. All that cannot be so transformed or refuses to be part of a divine consciousness, he will abandon without hesitation, but not from any preconceived prejudgment of its unfitness or its incapacity to be an element of the new inner life. In other words, not from moral conviction. That's an ugly fellow over there and we'll leave him outside. No, anything that is willing to change, to, in a sense, respond to the divine inspiration and touch, can be welcomed into the life. Nothing is necessarily outside of it. But what refuses, another matter. There can be no fixed mental test or principle for these things. He will therefore follow no unalterable rule, but accept or repel an activity of the mind according to his feeling, insight, or experience, until the greater power and light are there to turn their unerring scrutiny on all that is below and choose or reject their material out of what the human evolution has prepared for the divine labor. So, he alludes to the emerging sense of the soul, to the psychic tact that knows where to go and where to move. Who has the experience gathers the sap of the experience, and incidentally is that source in us which makes the true offering. How precisely or by what stages this progression and change will take place must depend on the form, need, and powers of the individual nature. In the spiritual domain, the essence is always one, but there is yet an infinite variety. And at any rate, in the integral yoga, the rigidity of a strict and precise mental rule is seldom applicable. For even when they walk in the same direction, no two natures proceed on exactly the same lines in the same series of steps or with quite identical stages of their progress. It may yet be said that a logical succession of the stages of progress would be very much in this order. So, although great variety is permitted, still there are some sensible definitions. Here's one. First, there is a large turning in which all the natural mental activities proper to the individual nature are taken up or referred to a higher standpoint and dedicated by the soul in us, the psychic being, the priest of the sacrifice, to the divine service. Next, there is an attempt at an ascent of the being and a bringing down of the light and power proper to some new height of consciousness gained by its upward effort into the whole action of the knowledge. So first, the psychic governance. And then an ascent and a descent to acquire a new height. So the one is the movement interiorly to gain access to the soul and convey its power to all the psychological members of the team. And then an ascent, once this thing is inside, because it's awfully hard to rise very far in consciousness until you have proceeded somewhat within. So first inside and then up. The ascent. And that must bring a normalization. This confluence of the descending force into the being enables us again to rise, attain new heights, but always we must bring back and assimilate and establish something real, something solid with it. He continues, here there may be a strong concentration on the inward central change of the consciousness and an abandonment of a large part of the outward going mental life, or else its relegation to a small and subordinate place. At different stages, it or parts of it may be taken up again from time to time to see how far the new inner psychic and spiritual consciousness can be brought into its movements. But that compulsion of the temperament or the nature, which in human beings necessitates one kind of activity or another, and makes it seem almost an indispensable portion of the existence, will diminish, and eventually no attachment will be left, no lower compulsion or driving force felt anywhere. So concentration may practically mean a restriction at some point, but later a release. Only the divine will matter. The divine alone will be the one need of the whole being. If there is any compulsion to activity, it will be not that of implanted desire or a force of nature, but the luminous driving of some greater consciousness force, which is becoming more and more the sole motive power of the whole existence. Consciousness force. So this is the chit shakti, acting in the nature, as we draw into communion with this higher conscious power, it acts more and more sovereignly through us, achieving the larger goal. This is the yoga shakti taking charge of the progress of the sadhana. It is a luminous driving, and it is the power of the existence. So you see here, sat chit ananda. Again, this is the chit shakti of sat proceeding to claim the lower nature, in a sense, to assume the divided lower nature back into its own higher nature. This is its first suggestion. This is the coming breath of grace descending from above, which we can feel as we rise higher and higher into conscious planes of true existence, where we meet the tactile reality of the spirit, because it is tangible, but in a way that is not tangible to the senses. So this is the higher nature invading the lower nature, one stage at a time. On the other hand, it is possible at any period of the inner spiritual progress that one may experience an extension rather than a restriction of the activities. There may be an opening of new capacities of mental creation and new provinces of knowledge by the miraculous touch of the yoga shakti. Aesthetic feeling, the power of artistic creation in one field or many fields together, talent or genius of literary expression, a faculty of metaphysical thinking, any power of eye or ear or hand or mind power may awaken where none was apparent before. And again, Sri Aurobindo is writing in 1932, half a dozen years after the establishment of the Sri Aurobindo ashram under his and the mother's guidance. And these powers of expression were becoming more and more visible and audible in the ashram community, because poetry is read aloud, music is sung or played, and mother was teaching people how to draw and how to paint, etc., in these early formative years. And so the whole aesthetic life of the ashram began to involve more and more people in this glorious period of its development. So, as he wrote this, this was becoming real in the ashram. The divine within may throw these latent riches out from the depths in which they were hidden, or a force from above may pour down its energies to equip the instrumental nature for the activity or the creation of which it is meant to be a channel or a builder. So, from within, the soul's power comes forward and, in a sense, manifests all the riches that are normally kept behind the screen. We have them, but we don't know how to get them out. The soul can show the way. Or they descend from above in an afflatus, that descent of light and power, which seizes the instruments here and compels them to express from inside or from above, and sometimes from both. But whatever may be the method or the course of development chosen by the hidden master of the yoga, the common culmination of this stage is the growing consciousness of him alone as the mover, decider, shaper of all the movements of the mind and all the activities of knowledge. So this is something that Sri Aurobindo had intimate experience with in his own sadhana, but also could point back to the Bhagavad Gita and luminous passages there where Krishna, speaking as Purushottama, says, "This I am, and I am stationed in all beings, and as you become aware of me, you'll become aware not only of me in you, but of me in all else." And this, the great liberating experience of the Vedanta. And there are two signs of the transformation of the seeker's mind of knowledge and works of knowledge from the process of the ignorance to the process of a liberated consciousness working partly, then wholly, in the light of the Spirit. So even though we're speaking here about the yoga of divine works, it is a yoga founded on a kind of communal knowledge. We commune with the Supreme, and by knowing that to whom we offer, the offering is perfected. The works become perfect because we know the author, the true author of the work. There is first a central change of the consciousness and a growing direct experience, vision, feeling of the Supreme and the cosmic existence, the divine in itself and the divine in all things. The mind will be taken up into a growing preoccupation with this first and foremost, and will feel itself heightening, widening into a more and more illumined means of expression of the one fundamental knowledge. So he uses the term central here. There's a connotation. It is a change here that favors the emergence of the psychic and the central being, reaching from the individual into the universal, into the transcendent. You'll remember from our study of the life divine that the psyche, the truth of the soul within us, is a power expressed immortally in the throes of time of that which is centrally held above as an expression of an eternal individuation of a universal and transcendent reality. And as we waken to our psyche, to our soul, we can connect back to that real individuality which is above, which is also us, but which is never divorced, not for a moment, not for a second, from the universality expressed as the transcendence, self-discovery, multiply and uniquely in all. So this is the first, basing this on the psychic and central consciousness within us. But also, the central consciousness, in its turn, will take up more and more the outer mental activities of knowledge and turn them into a parcel of itself or an annexed province. It will infuse into them its more authentic movement and make a more and more spiritualized and illumined mind its instrument in these surface fields, its new conquests, as well as in its own deeper spiritual empire. So there is an inner shift that then pushes the spiritualized awareness that we gain into the wide range of manifestation on all levels of the mind's activities. Then he proceeds, and this will be the second sign, the sign of a certain completion and perfection that the divine himself has become the knower, and all the inner movements, including the activities of what was once a purely human mental action, have become his field of knowledge. So here, the divine fuses into and becomes the knower with an enriching, transcending identity implanted in us. It isn't that we disappear, But we become identified with that, as the Gita again says. There will be less and less individual choice, opinion, preference, less and less of intellectualization, mental weaving, cerebral galley slave labor. A light within will see all that has to be seen, know all that has to be known, develop, create, organize. It will be the inner knower who will do in the liberated and universalized mind of the individual the works of an all-comprehending knowledge. So again, the transcendent works through the universal in the individual. These two changes are the signs of a first effectuation in which the activities of the mental nature are lifted up, spiritualized, widened, universalized, liberated, led to a consciousness of their true purpose as an instrumentation of the divine, creating and developing its manifestation in the temporal universe. Look at what is suggested here. Led to a consciousness of their true purpose. These things are not erased. The various aspects of our nature, which may be ignorant in their ordinary operation, given the chance to live in the presence of a divine light, can see what it is that they're meant to do, and joyfully plug themselves in and collaborate with the manifestation of a divine life. Not oppose, not obstruct, not obscure, but instead partner. But this cannot be the whole scope of the transformation. So this seems wonderful. This is magnificent. This seems that it consummates all that is possible to us. To be aware as the individual of universality and to know that one comes from this transcendent supreme, isn't this enough? He says, no. But this cannot be the whole scope of the transformation. For it is not in these limits that the integral seeker can seize from his ascension or confine the widening of his nature. For if it were so, knowledge would still remain a working of the mind, liberated, universalized, spiritualized, but still, as all mind must be, comparatively restricted, relative, imperfect in the very essence of its dynamism. It would reflect luminously great constructions of truth, but not move in the domain where truth is authentic, direct, sovereign, and native. There is an ascension still to be made from this height, by which the spiritualized mind will exceed itself and transmute into a supramental power of knowledge. Already in the process of spiritualization, it will have begun to pass out of the brilliant poverty of the human intellect. It will mount successively into the pure, broad reaches of a higher mind, and next into the gleaming belts of a still greater free intelligence, illumined with a light from above. At this point, it will begin to feel more freely, admit with a less mixed response, the radiant beginnings of an intuition, not illumined, but luminous in itself, true in itself, no longer entirely mental, and therefore subjected to the abundant intrusion of error. Here, too, is not an end, for it must rise beyond, into the very domain of that untruncated intuition, the first direct light from the self-awareness of a sensual being, and beyond it, attain that from which this light comes. For there is an over-mind behind mind, a power more original and dynamic which supports mind, sees it as a diminished radiation from itself, uses it as a transmitting belt of passage downward, or an instrument for the creations of the ignorance. The last step of the ascension would be the surpassing of overmind itself, or its return into its own still greater origin, its conversion into the supramental light of the divine gnosis. For there, in the supramental light, is the seat of a divine truth consciousness that has native in it, as no other consciousness below it can have, the power to organize the works of a truth which is no longer tarnished by the shadow of the cosmic inconscience and ignorance. There to reach, and thence to bring down, a supramental dynamism that can transform the ignorance is the distant but imperative supreme goal of the integral yoga. So, when we went through the Life Divine, of course, there was that late chapter, chapter 26 in the second book, coming close to the end, in which he described that radiant group of steps that led to the pinnacle, to the gate of the supramental, the higher mind, the illumined mind, intuition and overmind. The higher mind seizing and expressing universality in the form of thought. The illumined mind, beyond thought, but receiving substance of light from above, intuition itself, the edge of a ray of truth, and, in a sense, the overmind, a brilliant source of globalizing light, but itself drawing its power, drawing its glory, drawing its shape as an integer from the supramental. So to get to that supramental light and to bring its dynamism down is the supreme goal. To bring it and press it into the earth. That is the goal of the integral yoga. To transform not just mind, not simply to illumine the inner portions of our psychological being, but to press it into the energy that dominates and drives the universe, and then into the very form in which the universal functioning occurs, the body of matter. As the light of each of these higher powers is turned upon the human activities of knowledge, any distinction of sacred and profane, human and divine, begins more and more to fade, until it is finally abolished as osios, a word that means unoccupied or indolent. Here it means useless or futile. For whatever is touched and thoroughly penetrated by the divine gnosis is transfigured and becomes a movement of its own light and power, free from the turbidity and limitations of the lower intelligence. So it's claimed by the descending divinity. That form is claimed by that divine consciousness as it comes, so that it becomes an instrument of the divine light. It is not a separation of some activities but a transformation of them all by the change of the informing consciousness that is the way of liberation. An ascent of the sacrifice of knowledge to a greater and ever greater light and force. All the works of mind and intellect must be first heightened and widened, then illumined, lifted into the domain of a higher intelligence, afterwards translated into workings of a greater non-mental intuition. These again transformed into the dynamic outpourings of the overmind radiance, and those transfigured into the full light and sovereignty of the supramental gnosis. So the ascent means a greatening of the conscious power, and that all aspects, powers of our awareness have to be lifted up and transformed. So the ascent is an ascent of consciousness. It is an ascent of offering, but the ascent takes us up and lifts us into a diviner consciousness. So he is restating here what he said just a few sentences earlier. It is this that the evolution of consciousness in the world carries prefigured but latent in its seed and in the straining tense intention of its process. Nor can that process, that evolution, cease till it has evolved the instruments of a perfect in place of its now imperfect manifestation of the spirit. So all is embedded in conscious nature. Seems to be secret and obscure here, but must emerge and ascend until it attains its self-determined status above. It cannot be stopped. The evolution will continue until nature has fully risen and declared herself to be queen. That is the goal of the Mahashakti, and that the Yoga Shakti achieves step by radiant step in the progress of the integral yoga. So I think it's a good place to end, and I won't torture you with my voice much longer. This is a section, though, from Savitri, Book 10, The Book of the Double Twilight, Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real. This begins on around page 659 in most books. A few have dared the last supreme ascent and break through borders of blinding light above and feel a breath around of mightier air, receive a vaster being's messages and bathe in its immense intuitive ray. On summit mind are radiant altitudes exposed to the luster of infinity. Outskirts and dependencies of the house of truth, upraised estates of mind and measureless. There man can visit, but there he cannot live. A cosmic thought spreads out its vastitudes. Its smallest parts are here philosophies, challenging with their detailed immensity, each figuring an omniscient scheme of things. But higher still can climb the ascending light. There are vasts of vision and eternal suns, oceans of an immortal luminousness, flame hills assaulting heaven with their peaks. There, dwelling, all becomes a blaze of sight. A burning head of vision leads the mind. Thought trails behind it its long comet tail. The heart glows, an illuminate and seer, and sense is kindled into identity. A highest flight climbs to a deepest view. In a wide opening of its native sky, intuition's lightnings range in a bright pack, hunting all hidden truths out of their lairs. Its fiery edge of seeing absolute cleaves into locked unknown retreats of self, rummages the sky recesses of the brain, lights up the occult chambers of the heart. Its spear point ictus of discovery, pressed on the cover of name, the screen of form, strips bare the secret soul of all that is. Thought there has revelations, sun-bright eyes. The word, a mighty and inspiring voice, enters truth's inmost cabin of privacy and tears away the veil from God and life. Then stretches the boundless finite's last expanse, the cosmic empire of the overmind, time's buffer state bordering eternity, too vast for the experience of man's soul. All here gathers beneath one golden sky. The powers that build the cosmos station take in its house of infinite possibility. Each god from there builds his own nature's world. Ideas are phalanxed like a group of suns, each marshaling his company of rays. Thought crowds in masses, seized by one regard. All time is one body, space a single look. There is the Godhead's universal gaze, and there the boundaries of immortal mind. The line that parts and joins the hemispheres closes in on the labor of the gods, fencing eternity from the toil of time. In her glorious kingdom of eternal light, all ruler, ruled by none, the truth supreme, omnipotent, omniscient, and alone, in a golden country keeps her measureless house. In its corridor she hears the tread that comes out of the unmanifest, never to return till the unknown is known and seen by men. Above the stretch and blaze of cosmic sight, above the silence of the wordless thought, formless creator of immortal forms, nameless, investitured with the name divine, transcending time's hours, transcending timelessness, the mighty mother sits in lucent calm and holds the eternal child upon her knees, attending the day when he shall speak to fate. There is no good place to stop. Namaste, Jai Ma.